Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Stiglitz presiding.
All right, everyone, have a seat. All right. Calling 89421 Castillo versus Atkinson, Watkins, and Hoffman. Counsel, for appellant, are you ready to proceed?
I am,
Your Honor. All right, Mr. Finlayson, are you ready to proceed for the respondents?
Absolutely.
All right, come on up, sir.
May it please the court, my name is Brad Book, bar number 2662, for the appellant, Jesse Castillo.
All right, Mr. Brook, would you like to reserve any time in rebuttal?
I would, about 3 minutes, thank you.
All right, sir, when the first bell rings, that will start your 3 minutes.
Understood,
all
thank
right,
you.
Thank you.
The timeline of the case is, for me, the best way to explain the error the district court made in ruling that NRS 7.095 did not apply to the fee agreements in this case. The story that the timeline tells is that in April of 2020, the Patriot Law Firm signed Mr. Castillo to a contingency fee agreement. It's pages 388 and 89 in the appendix. That agreement, at that time, when no one was even thinking about anything other than medical malpractice, on its face violated 7.095 for obvious reasons. Number one, the contingency fee percentage greatly exceeded that which was permitted by the statute. And number two, it was calculated on the basis of gross recovery rather than a net recovery, which the statute required. So the agreement was void ab initio. And that is not even taking into account the fact that the Patriot Law Firm said nothing to Mr. Castillo about 7.095 and how the statute applied to his case. Then, fast forward 2.5 years or so to September of 2022, when the Atkinson Law Firm has Mr. Castillo sign a second fee agreement by sending him the following email, and I'm reading from it. It's at page 644 in the appendix. We were doing some file cleanup and noticed that you only have a retainer agreement signed with Burke's office. I wanted to get signatures on our documents, and quote, this does not change any of the arrangements that we have. This just formalizes the agreement you have with both firms, close quote. So there's the void 2020 fee agreement, and then there is this 2022 agreement, which also has a fee percentage greatly exceeding what the statute permits, and it also calculates the fee based on gross recovery rather than net recovery, and it essentially adopts, by its own terms, the 2020 fee agreement. And so it is also unlawful for those reasons. Then, to put both of the fee agreements into a substantive context, by April of 2022, there have already been three complaints in the case. There was an initial complaint and two amended complaints. All three of those complaints were styled medical malpractice, arbitration exemption claimed. All three allege 9 or 10 causes of action for medical malpractice. And only for medical malpractice. So it is not until April of 2022 that any mention of ordinary negligence even comes up. And even then, what is called, quote, in their terms, general negligence, arises from exactly the same set of operative facts, causing exactly the same injury that had been blamed on medical malpractice in the original.
So if we can fast forward a little bit, because we're going to run out of time here. So yes, they sought leave of the court to amend to add the ordinary negligence claim, and although it was contested, the court granted leave to add that claim, correct?
It did.
Okay. And so that claim was impending when, fast forward later, the parties reached a settlement, right?
Correct.
And although, as I understand it, I think there was a pending motion for summary judgment on that issue. Is that right?
There was.
Okay.
It was briefed, but never argued, never decided.
Right. Okay. And so isn't it fair to say that part of the reason for the amount of the confidential settlement was because of the risk the defendants had as a result of the pending ordinary negligence claim, which so far was still pending and potentially would lead to recovery for your client of more than the otherwise limited damages?
2 points on that, Your Honor. Number one, there's nothing in the record to that effect, and so it is entirely speculative.
Numbers?
Pardon?
The amount of damages for which it settled was more than your client would be entitled to under the limitations that apply to med-mal damages, correct?
That is correct. And I thought your question was whether there was some evidence that the claim, the unadjudicated claim, had something to do with the amount of the settlement. And the answer
The circumstantial evidence would certainly indicate that.
The circumstantial evidence to the contrary is much more compelling.
How so?
And that is that there was a $7 million plus economic loss claim also in the case. And that was hanging over the head of the defendants in making the decision to settle the case. But more important, there is nothing in the record that suggests that the amount of the settlement was based upon the ordinary negligence claim, which, by the way, when this case reached the lien litigation stage, there was nothing in the record about ordinary negligence other than the one allegation made by the lawyers, the same lawyers who asked for a fee that far exceeds that which is permitted by 7.095. I would respectfully ask the court to look at the language of the general negligence claim in the third amended complaint, and the court will see that the even that language clearly alleges medical malpractice. What the court will see is that all of the defendants in that claim are identified as licensed healthcare providers under the statute. All of the events took place at Sunrise Hospital, where Mr. Castillo was an inpatient. All of the events took place in the course of Mr. Castillo's treatment. And there is a common set of facts that support all of the claims, the seven medical malpractice claims and the one general negligence claim. The other seven claims in that same third amended complaint all refer to medical malpractice. There are two more timeline events that are telling. In July of 2022, before this dispute arose, before the fee dispute arose, in other words, at a time when there was no reason whatsoever to spin or to fabricate anything, the lawyers themselves styled the third amended complaint, quote, complaint, arbitration exemption claimed medical malpractice. That's page 192 of the appendix.
Sure. Well, there were still professional negligence claims asserted in the complaint.
And In October of 2022, even the addendum that the lawyers had Mr. Castillo sign on October 8th, 2022, the lawyers titled that document, Addendum to, quote, Medical Malpractice Fee Agreement, close quote. That's at page 393 of the appendix. So even after the third amended complaint was filed, the lawyers themselves were still calling the case a medical malpractice case. The bottom line is, if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. This is always and was always a medical malpractice case.
Counsel, if we don't go that direction, would you say that 7095 should still apply to cap the fees, even if we view it as a mixed case of ordinary and professional negligence? Was Mr. Castillo ever, advised that by putting in the ordinary negligence claims, he could recover more potentially?
Never.
Okay.
Never. We've briefed a handful of additional reasons why we believe the district court's order should be reversed. But frankly, the court need not go beyond the fact that Nevada voters decided in 2004 that attorneys' fees in medical malpractice cases should be limited. That voter initiative expressed and it established.
But the statute doesn't address what happens if there's some claims that are med mal claims and some claims that aren't, does it?
It does not.
Okay.
And
that's the problem for us to resolve, right?
I think not for this reason. The only piece of information in this case that takes this, that even could remotely take this case outside of 7.095, is a single allegation that was never litigated, that was never adjudicated.
None of the claims were litigated or adjudicated because they settled.
I think it's not correct that none of the claims were.
How so?
The case was litigated all the way through to the point of a motion for summary judgment being filed.
Right. Okay.
Mr. Book,
I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
Mr. Book will have 3 minutes. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Charles Finlayson. On behalf of respondents, Burke Injury Lawyers, and Atkins, Watkins, and Hoffman Law Firm. I'm happy to address any issue raised in the briefing, so if you have any questions, go right ahead. But I was going to start with the perfection issue, which was raised as Claim 5 in the brief. We're respectfully asking this Court to affirm the District Court's ruling relating to that issue for two main reasons. First, substantial evidence supports the district court's finding that Mr. Castillo constructively discharged his attorneys on September 7th, 2023, and the respondents perfected their charging lien on September 13th, 2023, before any funds were recovered. And alternatively, if this court disagrees with that, then respondents recovered and concludes that respondents recovered the funds before they perfected the lien, then the lien was still properly perfected as a retaining lien under Freddie and Ellie versus Price. I was also going to start with a timeline.
Okay. How does that help to have the retaining lien?
Because what this court held in Freddie and Ellie is that you can actually adjudicate a retaining lien by converting it into a money judgment. So any property or funds, if you conclude that the funds were possessed by counsel, which was their argument below, then the retaining lien could attach to that. And then you would still be able to convert that into a money judgment. And that was raised in the briefing below. 3, Appellant's Appendix 658 through 59. So
Mr. Finlayson,
yes.
I think I understand the lien issue is well briefed. I think my questions are really on the fee agreement. So this case straddled a lot of legal ground. It straddled the waivability of 7095. It straddled Curtis, and then it straddled Limpressert. So not your fault, nobody's fault really, just the timeline. So now we're at the end, we've come to the end of this case, and we're to intuit what is meant by a settlement agreement that is silent on A, the applicability of this, where the money's coming from, where it's going, and if in fact, I think to one of my colleagues' questions, you know, the argument is, well, if it doesn't say whether the cap applies, then tie goes to the runner and there's no cap. Well, why wouldn't tie go to the runner and the cap's imposed if some have med mal and some don't? Like, who do we construe that deficiency against?
So, a lot to unpack there. I completely agree with you. There's a lot of issues in this case. Primarily, the issue of NRS 7.095 is intended to be for pure medical malpractice claims. In the state of Mary Curtis and many of this court's decisions, it is recognized even recently that you can have both. You can have medical malpractice claims and you can have general negligence claims. And I don't think it was ever the intent of the voters or the intent of the legislature that you would cap all of it. I'll give you an example. We had a recent case that involved a sexual assault. And surely there was a medical malpractice component because it happened in a hospital, negligent hiring training, and then there was a direct claim against the hospital for this incident. Certainly the voters didn't anticipate that you would cap all of that.
Certainly. Now in this case, had this case gone to trial with that claim, was that a claim that in the current iteration of the law, Limpressert, this pleading, the facts known to you, was that a claim that would have sounded in professional negligence?
Had this came today?
Not settlement, we're on a trial now.
Correct. I think that the way I would look at this is that the general negligence claim was raised under the state of Curtis exception for common knowledge. That exception is no longer valid under this court's decision in Limpressert. But Limpressert came out after the settlement. And as the district court appropriately recognized when it was looking at this case, there's no way to go back in time and apply a future decision to a settlement that was already final. And the case was still ongoing because of this lien dispute, but the settlement was final. And when parties settle, they do so to end the matter. They do so accepting that the law is what it is on that day and to move on with their lives. I actually was looking up some law and I found a great quote from the Third Circuit. This is at 609 F3rd 590. It says, the choice to settle implicitly acknowledges calculated risks and in the end reflects the deliberate decision of both parties to opt for certainty in terminating their litigation. We will not relieve a party of that decision because in hindsight reveals that its decision was, given later changes in the law, probably wrong. I think it's the same analogy applies here. When you settle a case, you do so knowing that the law might change in your favor or it might change against you.
And just to be, sorry, please. I just want to, it's a small point, then I just want to be clear. I think you just agreed that this is true, but the settlement happened and the settlement checks came to counsel before the Limpressert decision issued.
The Limpressert decision issued while the lien notice was ongoing, yes. The first settlement check, so there was two settlement checks at issue. The first settlement check was cut on August 24th. It was picked up on September 7th, and it was deposited that same day once they received a letter from Mr. Sutherland directing him to deposit the check. The second check was deposited on September 14th, which was after the lien notice was sent on the 13th. So there's another wrinkle here because now there's two settlement checks, and the settlement notice, the lien notice that everyone agrees was properly perfected on the 13th, wouldn't apply to the second one. So, yes, this case straddles a lot of different points.
Sure.
A little Marco Rubio moment. Sorry.
No. Would the... Okay, go ahead. Yeah, I lost my train. Go ahead.
So actually, let me just go back over what you just said.
Okay.
When did, which law firm received the checks from the defendants who were paying the checks, and when did they receive the checks?
Burke Injury Law Firm picked up the checks, deposited it into the Burke Client Trust account. Again, the first one was deposited on September 7th. After Mr. Sutherland directed him to do that. This was after they received the letter from Mr. Sutherland, the email that was entitled Fee Dispute. And in that email, Mr. Sutherland...
Okay, so yes. They were deposited September 7th.
The first one.
When did they...
The second one was deposited on the 14th.
But when did they get the check? Had they gotten the check the same day or had they received it before that?
They picked up the first check on the 7th.
Okay.
It's not clear in the record when they picked up the second check, but it was deposited on the 14th.
So... It seems to me, and here's where you're going to have to fill in my gaps, it seems to me the judge attributed a lot of, for lack of a better term, like criminal mastermind to the injured party. Well, they tried to get more money by alleging this, having this complaint drafted this way, and now they don't want to pay their lawyers. So let's back up a second. Does the record reflect that adding that claim and the necessity of having the third was discussed with the client, and any implications that may have on the fee recovery or the recovery in general? After that was amended, and it's clear all the documents say MedMal, including the amended complaints, including the addendum to the medical malpractice fee agreement, all of them say MedMal. Was it ever discussed with the client on the record or in these records that adding this claim may cause him to share a greater percentage with his lawyers outside of any waiver issue or anything?
So I'm going to first disagree with you respectfully on the premise of your question of that. I don't think the district court attributed any fault to him. She was just saying this would allow you to do that. It would allow someone to argue in favor of a claim at one stage, only to turn around and disavow it later. So I don't think the judge was attributing any personal knowledge to Mr. Castillo. The record does not reflect whether they had this conversation with him. Mr. Castillo certainly disputed that they did. They certainly stated that they told him about the waiver provision. They said that they explained it, and so that was a dispute, a factual dispute, that was never resolved because the district court decided it wasn't appropriate to resolve it in the summary proceeding.
Well, we have a written waiver agreement.
Correct,
so
yes.
That explains how it does it, but yes. It doesn't explain, or there's nowhere in the record that I can find, and help me if it's there, that explains that if we add this, then that doesn't even matter.
No, I don't believe that there's anywhere in the record about that. That is something that the lawyers make the decision on making. They make the decision on what claims to plead and what the best strategy is. That's a lawyer decision that you don't necessarily discuss with the client. But there is an indication in the record that they talked about the focus group. They talked about the claims that were going to be the best claims at trial. And after the focus group is when they decided to settle the case. So I think you can infer from that the focus group didn't go particularly well for Mr. Castillo. Or you could also, I believe he says that he just wanted to do it because he started to lose faith in counsel. But this is just normal litigation practice. Certainly pre-Limpercert, this was something that plaintiff's lawyers, I think, was an effective strategy to do to get the best result for your client, particularly when you feel like your client was unfairly being held to a cap that shouldn't apply. So lawyers would do this, you know, and this court has put a stop to that practice for the most part. It certainly has issued many decisions that would make it more difficult for lawyers to do that. But that's the reason they had to do that is because this is what plaintiff's lawyers were trying to do. They were trying to maximize the result for their client. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's what we want lawyers to do. They have an obligation to do that for their client. But I don't think it reflects that they necessarily got into the nuts and bolts of what that would mean for him, particularly with respect to NRS 7095.
So was this settlement for, I guess, less than what the plaintiff's demands had been earlier?
The settlement agreement...
Sort of picking up that sense.
The settlement agreement, I believe in Mr. Burke's declaration, he said they had never made any sort of serious offer until that claim was added. It certainly was not for the amount that everyone was hoping for.
Right.
I think everyone hoped this would be a big case, particularly when the ordinary negligence claim was in there. Everyone felt bad for Mr. Castillo, but the settlement only happened after they added the general negligence claim. And I think you're completely right to point out that the timing kind of shows that was part of the reason why this happened, particularly because they did it while the motions for summary judgment were pending. If the defense wasn't worried about this claim, then they'd say, okay, well, we'll just wait for the court to rule on summary judgment, and this thing will be gone, and then we can settle. I think everyone did that because the state of Mary Curtis was governing law at the time, and it was a reason to you settle knowing there's risk on both sides.
We held in Nevins that we broadly construe this kind of consumer protection statute, right, the 7095. And we say you can't contract around it. And so I'm struggling to see why the default would then be to say that there's no caps in this settlement where the predominant claims are MedMal claims. And the entire complaint would be MedMal post-Limpercert. I understand and appreciate that Limpercert wasn't out at the time of the settlement. But why wouldn't the caps apply given our prior rulings in cases such as Nevins?
I believe this court has also held that the cap is in violation or derogation of common law. And so we also construe the cap narrowly because at common law, you could recover however much the jury felt you were entitled to. So, and again, the example I gave earlier, I think, is a perfect example of, I don't think this court wants to say, particularly in this case, because Lippert-Cert is out now, this is not going to happen much anymore, but I certainly don't think this court wants to say that if you've got one Med-Mal claim, then your entire case is covered by the Med-Mal cap. And I don't know how you draw the line. If there's 9 Med-Mal claims and 1 general negligence claim, I don't know how you do that. So I think the only way to appropriately construe the statute would be if it's a pure Med-Mal action, then the cap would apply. And if it's not, then the cap doesn't apply. But I also like to point out that this was not something that they ever argued. Their argument was just that it was Med-Mal and that this claim basically was fake. And that it, even under Mary Curtis, it would fail, which was the district court rejected that argument. Just briefly, I wanted to mention that as far as the lien perfection issue goes, and I just wanted to point out that because there was a mention of when they received the checks physically, this court has recognized that a check, when you hold it physically in your hands, you don't hold the money. You hold the check. It's a negotiable instrument. It's a promise to pay. So possession of the check is not possession of the settlement funds. It's just possession of a promise to pay the settlement funds.
How would you distinguish or otherwise say that the Golightly holding would not govern and say that receipt of the check by the attorney was in fact the recovery?
So Golightly was an interpleader action where the client was never going to get the funds because there was more, he owed more than the settlement. So he was never going to get the funds.
But he still had them in his trust account and then filed an interpleader action. And
correct.
I don't know, I can't remember if it ever actually got deposited with the court. I don't think it did.
Maybe eventually,
I don't know.
Right. I believe there was a dispute in Golightly whether you had to deposit it with the court.
Right.
I think it did at some point. The court said you didn't have to.
Right.
And it actually said that depositing it with the court is similar to holding in a client trust account because that's a neutral location. But again, at this point, when the clients deposited into the client trust account, the respondents, Mr. Sutherland had already sent them a letter saying, Mr. Castillo has no faith in you. Do not contact him directly. Contact him through me only. If you don't meet our demands, he listed various demands, then we are going to pursue further legal action against you. And what this court has explained is that all of that destroys the mutual trust necessary for representation. And so when that happens, that's a constructive discharge, where at that point, the respondent is no longer representing the client for the purposes of the settlement. So, and I have the decision here. There's an unpublished decision that this court specifically stated that in, and it's somewhere in my paperwork, but I don't have it. But constructive discharge occurs, according to this court, when the client takes actions or makes statements which prevents effective representation, and that's exactly what happened in this case. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court, 4 points. First of all, nothing about 7.095 or any of the implications of 7.095 were ever discussed in any way with Mr. Castillo. You will find a reference to that at pages 381 and 382 of the appendix. It is the affidavit of Mr. Castillo. He explicitly describes having been given no information whatsoever by either of the law firms about that. Second, with respect to perfection, the settlement checks are at pages 416 and 417 of the appendix. They are payable to both Jesse Castillo and the Patriot Law Firm. They are dated August 24th and August 29th. The lien letters are at 418 and 433. They were mailed on September 13th and September 29th. There is nothing in the record about the pickup of the checks or deposit of the checks, the checks payable to Jesse Castillo were in the possession of his agent, his lawyers, and the legal reality is that if they have received it and possessed it, which they did, then it is the same as if Jesse Castillo possessed it, which he did, and the checks were payable to both. Third, with respect to whether this case ever fell within the estate of Curtis case, the common knowledge exception in this case, again, was never litigated, and the only piece of information about it is the bald allegation that is made in the third amended complaint, which followed after a long series of complaints that alleged only medical malpractice. And last, point number four, the court raised the question about Limpercert and Nevins. This case was pending below when both of those cases became law in the state of Nevada, and both of those cases should be considered and applied.
But had the settlement happened at the time? So did the settlement happen before or after we published Limpercert?
The settlement occurred before Limpercert was decided. The lien litigation was pending when Limpercert was decided.
Understood.
Thank you, members of the court. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, John.